Welcome back to the Register Yard Roundup for this week commencing Monday the 31st of August, and we have a packed show for you today because we're very delighted to have with us two special guests. We have Jonathan Tsang, who is the Securities Finance Director of IHS Market, and also formerly from CMETR, so we'll come to that later on because obviously that's a topic that's come up quite a lot for us this year, in the last few months. And with Jonathan joining us, we also have Director of IHS Market, QP Dufourné-Tran, who is going to be talking to us about SFTR. Yes, IHS Market, as I'm sure you know, our market intelligence, big data analysis, pulling all kinds of different vectors together. And we're going to be talking about SFTR and going a bit more granular, in depth on what's worked, what hasn't worked, what have been the big issues. And guess what? The UTI will come up later in the show. Yes, we're going to be talking about UTIs. We're talking about reconciliation ratios. It's going to be jam-packed with juicy stuff. And we are delighted to have a full crew back this week as well in the virtual studio. Yes, holidays are over. Birthdays have been had and everyone is back where they should be, and that is of course in no particular order, but starting with the nicest and most efficient person in the organization. A big welcome back to Barbara Ruiz Alonso.
Hello everyone, I really missed you all these weeks.
We missed you too, Barbara. We hope you had a nice birthday. You know, you have the same birthday as Nick's wife.
I do.
I know, but they are not one and the same person. I'm just going to get that out there right at the beginning.
Well, you say that, but there is a rumor that they're never seen together. So, you know, I'm just saying, never seen them at the same time.
That is very, very true. This isn't a Michael Jackson situation. That's because I live in London and obviously Barbara's in Madrid.
That is true. Okay, that's true. And of course, that voice you'll recognize being back in the studio. He did join us last week, though, for our episode with Thomas Steinman, the CEO of Register RSA. Do go back and listen to that if you hadn't yet. Really interesting stuff about the future of fintech and the future of the business. And that is, of course, the dulcet tones of the voice of reason and head of business development, Nick Bruce.
Hello, everyone.
And also joining us this week back in the virtual studio, it is the legendary Dr. Evil of Brexit himself, the CEO of Register in the UK and the head of product in Europe, Mr. John Kernan.
Hello.
But before we go any further with that, this is a financial services podcast and anything could happen in the next 20 minutes. So we have to read a disclaimer to keep our compliance folks happy. And this week it will be read by the head of client services, Barbara Ruiz Alonso, and accompanied by Nick's son, Luke, who is going to be using his new Boss Looper pedal to lay down some groovy vibes.
This podcast is sponsored by Register and features members of the Register team offering their personal opinions. It is not intended to be taken as any form of legal, tax, or other professional advice, and there is no representation made as to the accuracy or completeness of the information, nor does it necessarily reflect the opinions of Register as an organization.
Yay! Okay, so we are back to our routine. John, glad to have you back to read the Brexit update. It's not such good news this week. It was looking a lot brighter, the one I read last week. Did I read it completely wrong? Have I just got the wrong end of the stick?
I think that's just coincidence. But yeah, look, as the negotiations between the UK and the EU over their future relationship stalled again in last week's seventh round of discussions, Brexit was actually removed from the agenda of a meeting of EU envoys this week, according to an EU diplomat. With only two rounds of formal negotiations left, starting on the 7th and 28th of September, ahead of the European Council meeting on the 15th to 16th of October, there's little time left to make progress in order to have an agreement ratified by both parliaments before the transition period ends. According to The Guardian, EU officials now believe that the UK government is prepared to risk a no-deal exit, and if so, would try to make the EU officially responsible if the negotiations fail. With little time left ahead of the ending of the transition period, EU authorities are asking UK banks to finalise and implement their long-term contingency measures despite COVID-19 disrupting relocation plans. The pandemic has created challenges in some of the plans and some adjustments have been agreed, but the overall principles remain the same, according to Piers Harbin, Director of Banking Markets, Innovation and Consumers at the European Banking Authority. A spokeswoman for the European Central Bank stated that some banks would have operating models already in place or on track to, but others would be falling short of expectations. According to Reuters, citing the new financial think tank, more than 60 banks in London would have to set up or expand operations in the EU, but not all would be ready. As a consequence, French clients of Coutts, a subsidiary of NatWest, have been informed in the letter that the bank would withdraw offering services to clients who reside in the EEA unless an alternative to the passporting regime is swiftly agreed at government level. A recent EY poll of July states that 94% of senior managers at London's largest finance firms said that they still would have work to do to even remain operational in case of a no-deal Brexit. So there you have it. More doom and gloom.
QP, you were at Morgan Stanley, obviously, an expert in securities financing. So you've got a nice global view here before you move to IHS Markets. And of course, like Jonathan, you're plugged into all this rich data and depth of analysis. With 5,000 people chewing through the numbers and everything, you must have a view on where you think this Brexit thing is going. Is it going to work out?
Yeah, well, it's quite difficult. So I think everybody is planning for the worst, and people are already starting to ask us what should we what should we do to prepare for the worst case scenario. So, and being based in Paris, actually. I can see also, some lively discussion, I would say, among the more, the French participants. We were very much involved with the trade association, and really everyone is really looking at, at the outcome of this, but preparing for the worst. Surely, now, I mean, the way the discussion of, the regulatory discussion are ongoing, competition will be much more important. You can see with the statement of the Chancellor of Exchequer, back end of June, that really the main motive is really regulation to also take into account competitive advantage, and no one is gonna want to lose on that ground, and want to have firm positions on both sides.
Now that's an interesting one, competitive advantage, because it's not going to be a level playing field, is it? If you're trading between a sort of cliff edge Brexit UK and Europe, if you want to trade in Europe, presumably you're going to have to supply even more data for things like SFTR than you do under the current regime.
Yes, absolutely. So you can see in some of the statements from the UK that. We move towards more, global requirements. So, the ones coming from CPMI, IOSCO, FSB. So no one will, will go against those principles. But then on the implementation side, you see, the devil is in the detail already. And there's not necessary harmonization of how you're going to implement that. So there could be some competitive advantage, problematic. It may be if it's, and I know that I think that Europe and are conscious about that if they are too stringent in their rules, which is good, at the target, but some other countries, may be more, I would say, pragmatic, and so they in the hearings that we have, with some of the regulators, it's just is this measure going to put you at a competitive disadvantage? Can you provide us figures? You know, this will come more and more into play, I think.
It's something we've discussed previously as well, and I think you're absolutely right, because even some of the rhetoric we've seen around the Brexit negotiations has been around the need to harmonise the regulation so that the UK wouldn't have an unfair advantage. And a lot of the questions we see as a TR as well is around divergence. So what are we going to see going forward around the application of a mere SFTR? And will you see a divergence from the UK? And I think from our point of view, I think whilst we talk about things being harmonised, it doesn't mean that things won't be tweaked, because everyone's going to have their own preference, and they're going to look and try and learn from what they believe are the key priorities and adapt slightly. And I think that's definitely a direction of travel and something that clients are quite aware of and quite worried about.
And about there's a very interesting point that QP mentioned, and it's about the authorities and what will be their role and their approach in this, let's say, initial phase of the Brexit months or even years, I will say, and we will need to see how they adapt to this new situation. Especially for me, the FCA will need to see in time if they keep the path of the EU, or if with the time we see differences, you know, coming up. And let's see in a few years where do we stand. So for me, it will be very interesting to see what is the approach taken by the authorities in both sides, right? In the EU, especially, you know, when all this happens, especially if it's a hard transition.
Well, on the subject of hard transitions, actually, things have gone pretty well, haven't they, for SFTR? We thought that was going to be a tricky one. But actually, it's going pretty smoothly. It seems to be a very successful piece of regulation at the moment. Although you have discovered in your analysis that there's a big gap, isn't there, between sort of pairing and reconciliation for trades and pairing and reconciliation for collateral. Jonathan?
Yeah, there's a general trend actually on the pairing side of trades that it's a lot more successful than collateral. I think what you find is certainly right now, you know, the pairing has been fairly successful. There's actually quite a few clients who have been pretty pleased about it, and it's definitely aided it. And if you compare it to, you know, EMEA, where there was a huge problem about pairing, and that's no fault of, you know, the regulation itself, is it was more to do with the fact that it was a little bit more stricter with the inter-TR reconciliation, you know, having a three fields that you could only pair with as part of the rec, whereas obviously we're doing it on a wider set of data fields and getting it prepared for want of a better word, before hitting the TR. So there's a chance that trades find its pair across the population within the platform. Obviously that does mean that the clients have to be on the platform in order to pair. And, you know, we saw that clients, you know, did a more, you know, work when they prepared for phase one, that they spent a lot of time getting their trades right in terms of data, trying to get the get a higher success in pairing.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I think that we were expecting, you know, worse than that, and actually everybody you know agree that the acceptance rates have been fairly high across the board, so you know with 99% for some asset class, a little less you know, more challenging for collateral side. For the pairing, as you mentioned, it's lower, but you have to bear in mind that for EMEA, for example, EMEA currently, the pairing and matching rate are only 40%. And for SFTR, even with the issues on collateral, relative issue compared to the trades, we're already at 50%, which are more or less, you know, despite all the issues that we have, especially in the inter-TR, reconciliation, there were some, you know, some light guidance. There's no there's no shame to have those stats. Of course, there are still some teething problems, especially around UTI. Most of the participants have been extremely engaged with all the TR, all the trade association. They have been a tremendous engagement, industry-wide testing. Everyone were focusing on the compliance with the ISO XML message, with the validation rules, some of which were subject to interpretation. The UTI is remaining quite a challenge with all the queries, but the stats are encouraging. There was a huge, tremendous progress even on the pairing race, even if we had stricter rules actually in implementing the pairing and the UTI algorithm. I think it's quite a big achievement, and the 3 months additional delay granted by ESMA was quite a pragmatic approach given the situation.
Tell us more about the issue with the inter-TR rejections, especially 18% of all those rejections are this action type isn't permitted for this kind of report. Well, what's that about?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So you've got a couple of issues there. That happens when the trade hasn't been submitted into a trade repository, and therefore you submit the corresponding collateral that relates to that trade into the trade repository, and the trade repository rejects it. That is very, very straightforward on a UTI, so a trade-based collateral. So if you send in, if you don't send in a trade side of that trade. It's a bit of a mouthful, into the TR, then the collateral that's associated with that trade UTI will not get accepted, which makes sense because the trade repository has nothing to reference it to. But on the net exposure side, which is a little bit interesting, is because of this backloading and before July the 13th, anything that's been executed before July the 13th is not reportable. You do have a situation where clients are not able to really carve out their collateral. We always knew from all the industry working groups that that clients would have an issue reporting collateral when compared to the open loans that were reported after July the 13th, whereby the collateral would always be more than or the trades that were open, or reported rather, after July the 13th. What this also brings is that there could be on occasion where client A trades with client B, and the only trades that exist on the book are open or executed before July the 13th. That is not reportable, but the collateral is net exposure, and because they're sending the whole book of collateral over to be reported, they can't actually carve that one out easily before hitting the trade repository. And that's also where client A and client C, where they have 50% of the book that's executed before July the 13th and the other 50% executed after July the 13th, the collateral will always be more than what's occurring on loan at a trade repository. So that was an issue that a lot of the participants within the working groups always said that it was just not possible. How do you even associate a particular collateral to a particular trade when it's net exposure?
Barbara, I mean, these are issues that land on your desk all the time, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that is precisely collateral. I will say if I need to mention two particular issues or questions we receive at the desk will be mainly collateral, and then, of course, reconciliation, which is like what happens after everything else, right? Then participants start looking at the reconciliation rates, which is common, and we've discussed about this also in other podcasts.
So, Barbara, presumably you're expecting the collateral issue to be something that keeps occurring on the client services desk for a little while yet.
I'm sure the collateral issues that Jonathan has brought will be extensively discussed in coming podcasts, and it will be very interesting to hear other guests' opinions, as you know, different point of views are always good, and we learn a lot, I believe, in all these podcasts. The challenges of the collateral, to me, they remain in the historical usage or the data availability. Of course, we have already discussed this with some of our clients also at the desk, that indeed, I agree with Jonathan that there's no a straightforward solution for some of these points, because it's basically just not possible, you know, to get all done at the same time. So I guess time will bring all the backloading into the TRs, and of course experience also. Time always brings experience, which in the reporting world is always good. So I guess we just need time to sort out all these problems.
So there's still some way to go on that. Jonathan, you're the SFDR analyst at IHS. I mean, what do you think? Is there still some way to go? Would you like to see, do you think there'll be an SFTR refit in a few years' time?
I'm sure there will be, maybe preceded by SFTR level 2 or something like that, if we wind back to EMIR. I mean, when you look at, if we wind back to EMIR and you look at the state of play there and compared to SFTR today, EMIR happened, there were 6 TRs back in those days, with 6 different versions of how to upload a transaction into the reporting, different formats, different interpretations, no fault of their own. But there was a very good sort of working group within the InterTR, with the InterTR working group. So they tried to thrash out the issues. With this time round, there's been a lot of focus, you know, with the trade associations, ISDA, ICMA, to try and get some consensus amongst all industry participants to get the trade reporting as good as they can. Also to give feedback to ESMA. You know, I think ESMA have received lots of reviews in terms of their consultations, just to try and get some clarity on some of the more, you know, some of the issues, some of the field issues that have created some issues for everyone.
Great. Now, I can't believe it. That is it. We are coming to the end of our time this week. Okay, so before we go, though, as we've got you here, Jonathan and QP, before we go, there's a question. We've been surveying, basically, the whole trade repository data industry, trying to work out what the optimal breakfast choice is. And we've had a lot of different options. Smashed Avocado has come up quite a bit. Seb Malik from Market Finreg loves a bit of apricot jam. Danny Corrigan, he's an oats and berries man, although he was technically a breakfast knack, we're now going to call it, because he doesn't make his own breakfast. His wife makes it in batches. So I'm gonna dive straight in. QP, what's your preferred breakfast choice?
Well, I didn't expect this kind of question. I will surprise you, honestly. I'm eating a bowl of soup at breakfast.
Soup.
That is new. That is new. Yeah. No one else said that before.
Yeah, but it's a special soup. I'm sorry. That's the usually the, you know, the Vietnamese soup with everything, with you know, noodles and chicken or beef, depending.
Wow, that sounds delicious. Actually, yeah. I had a pita bread this morning. I'm starving. Wow, I want that soup. I want that soup. Send the recipe.
Very, very easy to do. Very easy to do.
Yeah.
I will send you the recipe.
Do it. Do
yes,
it. Great.
Please, do it.
Yeah.
Okay, you heard that first on the podcast. There we are. I'm getting that recipe. Jonathan, what about you? What's your breakfast choice?
For anyone who worked in the city, I think it depends on what day of the week it was. Monday to Thursday, try to be healthy. Maybe a cereal, something like that, on Friday. Used to get something, you know, ham, sausage, and egg patty or something like that.
Oh, so, yes. The Friday bacon bap is something that I think we all miss. I mean, clearly our hearts and blood pressure don't miss it. But apart from that, you know, good. Okay, right, you heard it here. So Jonathan's healthy 4 days a week. And then one day he's going hard on the full English. Nice. All that remains is to give a huge Register Yard roundup thank you to our special guest this week from IHS Markets, and that is QP Dufourne Tran, who is a director and formerly a specialist in SFTR. QP, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also to the Securities Finance Director at IHS Markets, Jonathan Tsang. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
And also, of course, from the virtual studio crew, it's a big goodbye from the nicest and most efficient person in the organization, Barbara Ruiz Alonso.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, everyone.
And it's a big goodbye from the voice of reason, Mr. Nicholas Bruce.
Goodbye, everyone. And a huge thank you to QP and Jonathan.
And also, it's a big thank you from Mr. John Kernan.
Thanks, everybody.
So that's it. Do check out our LinkedIn page, and that is linkedin.com/company/regis-tr, and you will find the podcast there. You'll find a lot more information. You'll find all about our SFTR platform, now available in 4 different languages with support videos there. And of course, you'll see the chat that we have around each episode, and you will also hopefully find QP's recipe for breakfast soup, which may well find its way out there if I can persuade the authorities to let us post it. I'd rather just keep it for myself. In the meantime, have a good week. Have a safe week. If you are going back into the office, we hope it goes well. If you're still working from home, remember to reach out on your networks and stay connected, and do listen to our podcast, and we will see you again next week. In the meantime, bye-bye.